This is Deanna Spingola. It is Tuesday, April 9th, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Andrew S. McGregor. He is a retired police officer from Victoria, South Australia, and is an expert in analyzing false flag massacres. All righty. Thank you for joining me today, Andrew.
My pleasure, Deanna.
And where you are, it's morning, and here where I am at in the Chicago area, it's almost 6 p.m. in the evening. All righty. There's been a lot of information given out about Sandy Hook, and there's been a lesser amount of answers. I mean, we have all these questions, and I have looked at numerous videos and looked at numerous websites, and of course, I do not believe the official version of Sandy Hook.
I think there'll be a lot of people who wouldn't believe the official version, but they wouldn't have a full comprehension of what exactly happened there, and it follows the what we call the modus operandi, the way the criminals work. For most of the Lonut gun massacres that go right back to, go back to 1966 with Charles Joseph Whitman at the University of Texas. And that's been the main, we'll say, modus operandi that most of the government sites have been using with these Lonut gun massacres. Though they became quite obvious once we had the Port Arthur massacre on the 28th of April in 1996 in Tasmania. And, you know, I started studying that properly in 1998, and I did the transcript of the court hearing. There was never a trial for the gunman Martin Bryant, who did survive. And after you studied that, I then went back and studied previous Australian gun massacres. I helped Sandra Utley with hers after she wrote the book Dunblane Unburied, that pointed out that the supposed gunman at Dunblane, Thomas Hamilton, was murdered. He was shot through the mouth twice with a Smith & Wesson revolver when all the killings had been done with a Browning automatic. And it got very interesting from there. I wrote a good little article after the Virginia Tech massacre, and I sent it to a couple of people over in America, and I frightened the hell out of them because I mentioned the attempted assassination of Reagan in that and pointed to the vice president as being the main perpetrator.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I tend to agree with you there, especially with the Hinckley Association and the fact that, Bush really did want to be president.
Oh, he tried very hard. He was very upset. Who was the American businessman who came in and stuffed up his second attempt, his second run? That divided the vote sort of thing, and that allowed Bill Clinton.
Right. I know who you mean. I have a campaign button from him. Who was that guy? Oh my goodness. He's the guy that said, as soon as we pass NAFTA, you're going to hear a great big huge sucking sound of production go right out of the country. Oh my goodness, what was his name? I'll think of it as we go along here.
It doesn't matter, but...
And he was a Texan, Ross Perot.
Yes.
Yes.
So, but my daughter's giving me a message.
Okay. Well, the whole Sandy Hook situation, I remember that on that day, I was just about to go on my regular RBN broadcast, and they announced it probably 15 minutes before, and I announced it on my radio program, and I mean, that was just a very terrible situation. And but then after you start evaluating it and looking at it, looking at the photos, and seeing, and just not seeing any bodies, not getting any real information from the medical examiner, having these parents go on and talk about it on various programs, and yet we didn't see any bodies. And there's also been speculation that the school was not even operating at that time, that it had been closed.
Yes, and this would be extremely it would really affect the victims, the parents of the deceased and things like that. You will find that the massacre did go down, but it went down so badly, it wasn't funny. You had, what was it, you had the operation going down at Carmel Elementary School just down the road. I'm told it's about 35 minutes away, with the emergency response police and all the first responders there, just waiting for the court to come in and get onto the real thing, unbeknown to them, except possibly for one or two people. The you have a look at the legislation that was brought in earlier last year in regard to children being victims of homicide, and you say, look, you know, why would they bring in such legislation? And then when you have a look at Sandy Hook, you said, right, that is why they brought in this particular legislation. And again, similar things happened with the Port Arthur massacre, where the legislation in Tasmania removed the right for workers to claim for post-traumatic stress disorder if they'd survived the event, and that the coroner's court was found that it could not bring forth a motion that differed from a higher court. And that again was used by the coroner, Ian Matteson, to close down the coronial inquiry into the Port Arthur massacre on the, I think it was about the 14th of January 1997. So that becomes extremely interesting. But no, there would have been an actual shooting there. The 28 people would have died, but as I said, it was so stuffed up that they brought in all different types of stories.
Right. Now you mentioned in an article that on the 14th of October 2009, the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the State Department announced that it was instigating with the UN an arms trade treaty. And the Obama administration in 2009 was prepared to have the Second Amendment regulated by a body outside of the American Constitution.
Yes, well, United Nations is not mentioned within the American Constitution. It has no right. It is not American. It is globalist.
Right. And so this whole situation causes one to say, well, are they creating these situations where the people will demand a solution? And, of course, in the Hegelian dialectical, that's what happens. They create legislation that they would like to pass, and since the population will not accept such legislation, they create a problem wherein the population will demand a solution, and they have this legislation, you know, hidden in the background that they're all ready to present and say, okay, we've heard your cries, your pleas, and here's the legislation. We are going to protect the nation's children. And of course, everybody is going to be sympathetic when children are killed.
Not everybody.
Well, yes.
But you see, when you get one incident, I call it a political agenda. When you get one incident, one in a billion incident, and the government reacts to that one in a billion as though it is the norm, you start asking what's going on. Then when you have a look and you see this one in a billion incident actually fits into their political agenda, you know that it was a political stunt.
Right.
You have a look at 9/11. It was a political stunt for the simple reason of brought in the Homeland Security. Nobody, no politician could actually read the act, but they all passed it. So you become aware that these things are a political agenda. You have a look at the Brady gun control movement. Again, it has been prepared, and that's the political body, or one of them, that's pushing the agenda for the removal of firearms. And if people can't remember, Brady was the secretary, the press secretary of Ronald Reagan. He was shot in the head during the attempted Reagan assassination.
Right, right. And his wife was very active in getting that bill passed. And as you say, Patriot Act, that was actually written in 1998, but they knew that they could not pass it without some sort of a new Pearl Harbor, as they say in the PNAC documents.
The interesting thing, can you tell me the first politician to actually mention that America had suffered another Pearl Harbor?
Was that Bush?
No.
It was, who was it?
It was the Australian Prime Minister, John Howard, who was at Washington meeting with his friend Rupert Murdoch. And he stated, now, the attack, I think, started about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock Australian time, because I was at the Atherton Tablelands in Queensland, far north Australia. And at 9 o'clock, so that's 7 hours after the event, or within 7 hours of the event, that the Australian president made his speech to Australia saying that America had suffered another Pearl Harbor. So I don't think Johnny Howard had his scriptwriters with him in America at the time, but I'm quite certain Rupert Murdoch had his.
Certainly.
So, you know, that's just another little interesting thing. Now, you then have a look at the London bombing, and who was over there for the, the G8 meetings?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Again, you have little Johnny Howard, and there was a celebration over there, what I call a mutual friend society between Rupert Murdoch and little Johnny Howard. And, of course, Tony Blair was in the background to bring in his promise of troops to Afghanistan immediately following the London bombing.
Right.
They had found out who the perpetrators were at that stage.
And of course, they had them all lined up so that they could blame it on people, on the Muslims.
Well, they even had a program on the Panorama on the BBC on the in May 2004, a year before the actual bombing,
right,
of the whole scenario going down. So, you know, it's I don't know how many Muslims work for the BBC, but I'm quite certain that they wouldn't have been running the show.
Exactly. Well, they always have somebody lined up to take the fall for it, like with Adam Lanza. They had him all scheduled to take the fall. And when you look at, try to find his presence on the internet before that day. I mean, everybody is. I think most people are on the internet. They send email. They have a website. They have Facebook. They have something. But there is absolutely no inkling of a presence with Adam Lanza before that date.
Well, that's not my area of expertise.
Okay.
But I can tell you that most people that have been selected as patsies or fall guys, whatever you like to call them, in these low nut gun massacres have all been come under a psychiatrist's attention. Julian Knight was a former army cadet officer in the Australian Army. He had just recently been discharged, and I think he was going into mild schizophrenia. It was Frank Vickovich who did the Queen Street Massacre. He was a brilliant university student, but he was having problems, and he was sent to a psychiatrist, and that report, for some unknown reason, wasn't followed up. Martin Bryant was had been examined for years, definitely schizophrenia, and in it was April 1994, the Hobart Supreme Court, I think, placed him under a guardianship with perpetual trustees. So that tells you that yes, he did have a mental problem. It would have been schizophrenia. But once he survived the burns, the third degree burns that he received at the fire at Seascape Cottage, he couldn't be found to be schizophrenic, because that would then mean that he wouldn't be competent to plead, which means there would have to be a trial. So the psychiatrist stepped in and made some lovely comments about him and about most of these Lone Nut Gun massacres. And it was Cantor, Mullen and Alpers had an article written, Psychiatry and the Law. It was published in America in 1999. And one of the terms they used for these Lone Nut Gun massacres was AMOC, which is a Malaysian syndrome, where the Malaysians, if they lose face or are totally embarrassed, they can't commit suicide, so they run around killing everybody until somebody kills them. And that's AMOC. And then they try to say that Caucasian people, are now doing this AMOC thing, which is totally ludicrous. But they've written it down there in an effort to explain why we get these Lone Nut Gun massacres. And when you have a look at them, the three writers are totally anti-gun. So it becomes rather interesting.
Indeed. Well, give us your thought. You've made some comparisons with other false flag events, and probably there are even more. What about the one a couple of years ago? It seems like there's so many that I can't even think of them.
They only arise when there's need for gun control. That's the first one. Uh-huh. You'll get gun shootings where people are upset, but then once police investigate them, you can come up with some fairly clean answers of why it happened. The Lone Nut Gun massacres, there is no real reason why they occur, why somebody's suddenly erupted and gone out and killed people that he's never met or has got no connection with, which includes Sandy Hook. But look, I'll give you the thing on Sandy Hook, which is rather interesting. You get the first police message come along, I think, about 9:35:52, that there was a teacher reporting there's shots being fired at the school. And so you get the first police responders go to the school, and within 3 minutes, the shooting has stopped. So you look at that, you say, right, the shooting is taken within three, you've got 3 minutes for the shooting to actually take place, no more. A maximum time limit of three minutes. The first thing you spot is that, you've got the dead Adam Lanza lying down there. He's got two pistols with him, a Glock, which is a police weapon, and a Sig Sauer or something other, which I'm told is the secret agent's handgun. There's no 223. So the first police report come up and state that there's these two handguns there. You've got X amount of kids that they must have all been shot with the handguns. There's no 223. Why? You get the coroner, H. Wayne Carver, who says they're all shot with a 223. There's no 223 weapon on the scene. What happened to the weapon? Later on, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, someone says, "Oh, look, the 223 Bushmaster is in the boot of the Honda."
Yeah. So wow. How's it get there?
Ah. Yeah, you see, the first thing you've got to realise is the boot of the Honda's locked. I mean, you go up, where's your car at the moment? It's in the garage.
Right, it's in the garage.
Is the boot open?
No.
Right. Well, how do the police, did they open it? They're not allowed to. The first responders wouldn't be allowed to. So what you've actually got is you've got a gunman shooting the kids, and again, Dr. Carver tells us that the kids, most of the children were shot multiple times, between 3 and 11 times. Now, if you've got a group of kids huddled up, you don't use a Bushmaster with a 30-round magazine to shoot a kid 3 to 11 times in the body. How many magazines? I think they said there's 154 of them. Other reports might be 157 shots fired to create these wounds. We'll say 150, that's five rounds. 154 means you've now got six rounds or six magazines of 30 rounds. It would take you all bloody day. And, you know, you shoot one person, you might shoot them twice. Shoot them when they hit the floor sort of thing, then shoot them in the head to make sure certain that they're dead. But in one of the classrooms, apparently one girl survived by feigning that she was dead. She didn't move. I don't know how fortunate or unfortunate she would be, because she's going to have nightmares for years. But you have a look. The only way that this type of shooting could take place was if it was a fully automatic, and that means it's got to be using a 100-round mag. It won't be the Bushmaster. But the real interesting thing, the first responders get there is no murder weapon. What happened to the murder weapon?
Yes, whoever
used it left the scene. How do we know he left the scene? Well, the first responders again state about the red maroon van with the registration number 872-YE0-YE0 sort of thing, leaving, and they asked for details, and they apparently got it back. That became rather embarrassing, so the police then had to change that registration number over to Nancy Lanza's black Honda, and somebody's put the plates on the Honda, because when it's on the tow truck the next morning. Now, people say police would never do that. I was in the Victoria Police Force up for 17 years, 16 days. Oh, yes, police will do that every time. Police frequently are better liars than the normal citizen. So there's the missing murder weapon for a start, and we're told that quite simply because the police state that, the only two weapons there is the Glock and the Sig Sauer, the two handguns, so therefore they must be the murder weapon. But the first police will also go into the room where the children have been murdered, and there's 2-3 cartridges all over the place. And you can imagine what they would say to that. So they would then go out and try to find where the murder weapon is. Now, if Adam Lanza had been the gunman and the murderer, where would he have the murder weapon?
With him, obviously.
Yes, it's not with him. Why? The simple reason is because he didn't use it. If the murder weapon is not on site, that means somebody's taken it away. They've got 45 seconds for the person to be doing the shooting in the classroom to actually leave the classroom and leave the site of the murder or the massacre. The only vehicle sighted leaving was the red maroon van with the black back window blown out. So therefore, the gunman has escaped in that vehicle, and he's taken the murder weapon with him. He's also taken the magazines with him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there was no report of any magazines by police in the original description. All they had was, the only weapons they've got on site is the Glock and the Sig Sauer. That's fine. So you know that the gunman has actually been able to get out and escape, and the only way he'd have time to escape was if he was monitoring the police communications, if he had a little earplug.
So of he could course. Actually,
no problems with that. So the next thing we get is when the police first arrive, there's still shooting going on. But there's no murder weapon. Well, that means that somebody else has been doing shooting. Why? So you then have a look. The following day, you're told that the handguns that are with Adam Lanza have jumped from 2 to 4, and it'll be another 2 Glocks. The reason being that the two men, they'll be used to, one would be to hold Adam Lanza while the second one shot him. More than likely they'd hold him on the ground. When the police first arrived, they had to leave the area without being seen by students or teachers. The only way they could do that is when they were leaving is to fire off shots, so as to keep everybody away from windows and huddled on the floor. And they'll be firing, more than likely they'd fire those shots into the air as they went past, and they'll be fired from the police Glocks. So the police investigators now have X amount of bullet holes around, you know, where these two men left. And these bullet holes have to be explained, so the 2 Glocks are then placed with the body of Adam Lanza. So we've now, that will now cover the extra bullet holes created by these two men leaving. The third one is one of the police responders found a weapons cache of long arms and a shotgun. They were, I think it was the Henry repeating rifle and Enfield and a shotgun. And it's later on, Lieutenant Paul Vance gives us the actual name of the shotgun, because that was the shotgun that was found in the boot of the Honda. So you've got two policemen holding Adam Lanza on the ground and shooting him, then firing shots in the air as they move out from the school, and shortly afterwards they are apprehended because the teacher sees their shadows moving past the gym. And you hear the police response, right, I've got them, they're coming towards me. And then shortly afterwards he says, I've got them prone out. And then there's another chase later on up into the wooded areas. And after that chase, and that person is caught, they find the cache. So you've got a team of two guarding and taking Adam Lanza to where he's to be executed. You've got a third bloke who's dumping weapons around, sort of thing. And this is required to demonize these particular weapons. Right.
The Glock is probably the most popular gun for personal protection, and I know all the policemen use it. It's the gun that they show on probably all of the programs on TV. Certainly. And it is an automatic weapon.
Yes, but the main move for the Second Amendment is to remove the long arms and shotguns. It's exactly the same scenario down at the Port Arthur massacre in 96 in Tasmania.
Okay.
So, you know, it's exactly the same. So you've got one policeman dumping all these extra weapons around. He doesn't get the chance to escape, and besides that, their escape vehicle has already left. And you've got the two policemen who had to kill Adam Lanza. So they're caught. The local police catch them. And I think one of the witnesses who saw this event was astonished when the police took this arrested suspect. Instead of placing him in the back of the van, back of the police car, they put him in the front. And then later on...
Yeah, that is a little bit strange.
Yes.
And the whole logistics of the situation, I mean, 154 shots in a period of, 3 minutes? It just does not make any sense.
Well, again, police lie. And, you know, when they've got problems, they've got the 3 minutes for it. So what's now being stretched from 5 to 10 minutes, if they get their way, they might even throw in another 5 minutes to make it 15. It doesn't happen. The police response was described by Paul Vance on the first day as instantaneous, and it just about was. You know, 45 seconds, that's fantastic. I wish we'd had that in Australia, but we our response times are a little bit longer than that.
Right. And so, there were a lot of people killed in that incident there.
At Port Arthur, there was 35 killed and about another 22 wounded.
And those involved, some of those killings involved children.
The main, there was 15 and 17-year-old girls were killed inside the Broad Arrow Cafe. But the main two were the Mikak children who were killed up near the toll booth.
Right.
And they were deliberately targeted by the gunman there. Yes. But the Sandy Hook massacre, you know, once you get, how do you pronounce the name F-U-C-H-S? The police chief, Douglas, is it Fuchs or Fox or?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Well, when he gets up at a bipartisan meeting at the Newtown High School on the 14th of January to state that when he and his two of his men were at Sandy Hook at 9:45 a.m. And you think, yeah, how many idiots are there? It's, in Australia, we'd use the term dickhead. I don't know if I'm allowed to use that on your program.
Well, I think it's already too late, but don't worry about it. This is one of those non-commercial, private little interviews, so it's fine.
Yeah, but he's, you know, he gets up to push forward the propaganda required for, you know, for the destruction of the Second Amendment and for this disarming the American population of their long arms and you know, the multiple magazines. I think in Australia now, for people who go out hunting and that, the largest magazine they're allowed to have is a 4-round magazine. That's real good for shooting foxes.
Sure.
Yes, so this is what they'll be trying on America, and I think you've really got to resist, because once your government, or your government agency start killing, its own citizens, you've got problems. But when they go for maximum effect and start killing school children, it's high times within the whole bureaucracies and that will be placed. And you have a look. You've got the BATFE now. You've got the FEMA. You've got Homeland Security. Look, what other country do you know of in the world sort of thing does checks on people, you know, moving from point A to point B as you do in America at the airports?
Well, actually, I was in China in 2007, and there was less security there in the airports than there is here.
Well, you see, America being so large, a lot of people can't drive from point A to point B, so they fly. But the reality is, the only other country in the world that has these police spot checks and everything else going on is Palestine.
Right, exactly. I was in Palestine in 1999, and even there, that early, they had checkpoints, and they had there was a big military presence there. They had guards all over, and this was relatively early.
And you go to the airports, what have you got? You've got Department of Homeland Security there checking for terrorists.
Right.
You know, what terrorists? The only terrorist is somebody who disagrees with the established government.
Right.
The government isn't the Congress. When was the last time, I asked the question in Australia, when was the last time Australians voted to change the government? People said, oh, in the last election. I said, no. People have never, they vote to change the parliament, never the government. And a lot of people tend to forget that, you know, little government bodies, you know, can go on for 50 years without being changed.
Sure. And this one has certainly gone on a long time. And the problem with this current situation and the gun legislation that they are trying to push is the media. The media does not really represent the population at large. They represent the corporations. They represent the elite agenda. They represent what the government would like to have happen. And of course, this has been true since 1927 with the Radio Act of 1927, which gave censorship authority to the government. And people don't realize that because they've been told for such a long time that they live in a free country and that they have a free press and that we have transparency, and that just isn't true. So what we see here in this country is we see a lot of people that represent the multinational corporations and the government and their agenda. We see them on TV saying, oh, yes, we've got to have tougher gun laws. We've got to have background checks. We've got to have this and we've got to have that. And then they exploit the incident at Sandy Hook and they say, well, look what happened. And then today, just today, this afternoon, there was, I'm not sure of all the details, but there was a knifing where several people, I don't know whether it was 18 people, were slashed with a knife by this one lone knifeman. And I'm thinking, my goodness, how could one person do all of this damage in a relatively short period of time? How does that happen? And even at Sandy Hook, if you have somebody coming in that's shooting and you have all of these other people, teachers and whatnot, I mean, I would try to stop the person that's doing it or allegedly doing it. And so when you have a gunman that goes in and does all of this damage without any opposition, you have to ask questions.
In Australia, the I call Melbourne, which is the capital of the state of Victoria, the Lone Nut Gun Massacre capital of the world. We had two gun massacres in 1987. The first one was on the 9th of August. That was at the Hoddle Street. That was Julian Knight. But he got arrested by two uniformed members of the Fitzroy Police Station. And the, you'd call them dispatchers. It's our VKC, they had already told the uniformed members and that to clear the area, stop the traffic, and to wait for the special operations group or SWAT team to arrive, you know, which would take a minimum of 30 minutes. So that would be allowing the gunman to continue killing civilians for 30 minutes without police doing anything about it because, oh, no, the our things are on the way. Well, you know, yes. So you can see that the role of the police is now there to follow government procedures much rather than to protect the local community.
Sure.
The second one took place in about the 6th or 8th of December 1987 in a secured federal building in Queen Street, Melbourne. That was the post office philatelic section. Now, there were security doors on every floor. But this particular gunman, Frank Vukovic, got the lift up to the 13th floor, came down the fire escape door and got into the 12th floor and continued his killing there using a sawn-off M1 carbine. He'd fit it into the bag that he was using to carry this gun to the site or to the area he was going to do the massacre. The firearm was too long, so somebody cut off part of the barrel and part of the stock, which stopped the gun from being a semi-automatic, and it had to be hand loaded each time. And any jerks and that sort of thing, the M1 would jam. And there's about 180 rounds of the thing that had been ejected because it had jammed. But in this particular case, one on the 12th floor, two men were able to grab him. One was shot and wounded, but they still managed to grab him, take the firearm off him, pass it to a girl who hid it in a fridge in an office. that's a refrigerator, whatever you call them over there. And the gunman ended up then trying to escape. He jumped through a plate glass window on the 12th floor, hung to the edge for a little while, and then fell to his death.
Now you indicate
There's one very extremely interesting thing on the witnesses. On the building directly opposite, on the 24th floor, was the office of the State Attorney General, Jim Kennan. On that particular day, he was visited by the police minister, Race Matthews. And they both then went down to the typist pool on the 12th floor and were watching the massacre.
Just watching, or did they respond? Did they call anybody?
No, they were watching what was happening. And they were seen there by a security guard. How did they know it was going to occur? Anyway, one of the things that Frank Vicovich was yelling when he was going around killing all these people was, how do they expect me to kill people with this gun?
Oh!
Who on earth were they?
Indeed.
So anyway, it gets very interesting. In the next, it should have been a Lonut gun massacre. It was a Peter Knight. Went into the abortion clinic in East Melbourne. Placed a locking device on the front door so nobody could get in. Shot the security guard, and then one of the boyfriends of one of the patients there. He jumped up and grabbed the gunman. He then got helped by a few other people, and Peter Knight was caught and arrested. He only killed the security guard. And so again, you know, the victims. This is the second time that the victims actually jumped up. Then in the third massacre at the Monash University, with the Xiang was the gunman. He was going through a classroom. He suddenly came up with a handgun, which were the only illegal weapons he could have at the time. It started. He shot his two Asian student friends first, and then started on the others. Again, a student jumped up and grabbed him, and the lecturer, Lee Gordon Brown, came up. He got wounded, helped and held him as well, and the associate professor, Brett Inder, from the next room, when the shooting stopped, came into the room and took over and held Zhang for a while. And Zhang said to him, "It was all I could do." Then 2 months later, Professor Brett Inder makes comments about a container load of Beretta handguns coming into Australia, and you immediately realise that he is part of the gun control. So, so he was the controller of that operation.
Right. Now, who do you think did it here? You have to figure out, okay, it's in Connecticut. Allegedly 20 children were shot. The lone gunman, Adam Lanza, apparently killed his mother, took her car, drove to the school. Why would he drive to the school? There was so much conflicting information. Somebody said, she was a teacher. His mother was a teacher at the school. There was no security within the Sandy Hook Elementary School. The other thing, because it was close to Christmas, which is very interesting, there was no Christmas decorations on the windows. The parking lot seemed to be no cars in the parking lot. It just seemed like it was set up in order to facilitate this operation, in order to meet a political agenda that they've been wanting to implement for some time.
Right. Well, first of all, you've got the three policemen. You've got Douglas Fuchs stating he was there with two of his men. So they'll be the men who would be depositing the required, or trying to. I don't know how many guns that were still left in the maroon van that when it took off. But you've got folks. That'd be what I call Team B, at the execution of Adam Lanza, much the same as Thomas Hamilton was executed in Dunblane. He was shot through the mouth twice with a Smith & Wesson handgun. That's supposed to be a suicide.
Yeah.
And so you've got the team. But the main part of Team A is the person who escaped, and that was the actual gunman who took the murder weapon with him. And as I said before, it's got to be 100 round. You've got 15 or 20 and 30 round magazines for a Bushmaster or an AR-15. But then you'd also get a 100-round mag. And that's for virtually firing on fully automatic. Mm-hmm. So the weapon they've used at Sandy Hook is a fully automatic AR-15 with a 100-round magazine.
Right, okay.
And that has left the site. It can't be found. And so once you've got that, he must have left. How did he leave? Well, the only vehicle seen leaving was the red maroon van with the back window shot up that was supposedly owned by somebody, Christopher A. Rodier or whatever his name was, supposedly from Connecticut. And again, he's got the police record, and you know that's false.
Sure.
So, but who was the gunman? I don't really know. I was thinking it might have been Ari Benbenashi from Montreal.
Really?
Yeah. So he's 61 years of age. But, you know, Brian Hutchinson reports of the thing in the last period of time, sort of thing. He's gone on a fitness program. He's a lot fitter. He's thinner, sort of thing. You say, why? Then you get the report on the 3rd of December that his house burnt down.
Wow. Right. Uh-huh. Okay. And he's an Israeli intelligence officer.
No, he's not. He's British.
Oh, okay. All right.
He's British. Look, what happened to the five Israelis that were filmed the planes crashing into the...
Oh, they went home. And appeared on TV in Israel.
Well, what happened to the 250 Israeli operatives, you know, the art students that were arrested? And
they probably went back to the Israeli state also.
They were all deported home. Uh-huh. When was the last time you ever heard of an Israeli intelligence officer or any intelligence officer telling, you know, dropping in the country that they worked for?
Hmm.
They don't. What happened to the last Australian Mossad officer who, the one who portrayed the killing of that Hamas bloke in Qatara, whatever it was, a couple of years ago? The passport scandal. What happened to him?
Exactly, I don't know.
Well, he was locked up in a very secure, suicide-proof prison in Israel, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Uh-huh. Yes.
And then he committed suicide.
Allegedly.
Well, in a suicide-proof cell, he committed suicide?
Yeah.
Yes, I don't know who helped him. So, no, the reality is, if Ari Benbenashi had been an Israeli sort of thing, he would never have dobbed in Israel. He would never have made the claims he has made. And so that tells you it was a psyops, and Ari Benbenashi was British. He was never an Israeli. He never worked. And anyone who said so sort of thing was would have been working with him. The classic case, I think, was Craig Amberger or something or other, who stated in the Village Voice. You listen to Ari, you listen to him, you believe him, you take him at his word, you write it down verbatim, and then you watch your career go up in smoke.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And Ari Benbenashi was a British agent, and the actual role was, the person who played the role of Ari Benbenashi was a person called Otho Jewell Biles, or he's commonly known as Joe Biles. And he was residing in Australia from 1989 until he supposedly died in 2005. He played Ari Benbenashe again in Zimbabwe for Robert Mugabe, but that again was to relieve the CHOGM. Now, CHOGM is the Commonwealth Heads of Government Meetings. There was one being held in Brisbane in 2001, 2002, and there was a lot of pressure on them to resolve the Zimbabwe situation where all the white Zimbabweans were being murdered by Mugabe's people. And after Ari Benash went over there and had the opposition leader charged with attempting to assassinate Mugabe, the CHOGM thing was, they just wanted to make certain that the elections in Zimbabwe were fair and, you know, and legal.
Right. So what connection do you draw between this fellow?
Ari Benbenashe is Joe Viles. Joe Viles apparently supposedly died of kidney failure suddenly in about June, July 2005. And at the same time, Ari Benbenashe resurfaced back in Montreal, where he has been doing all his work with his partner in crime, Alexander Henry Legault. Now, Alexander Henry Legault was actually played by Henry Ayers of Alaska, who died a couple of years ago.
Okay. And Robert Perry wrote the story about his house up there, and he apparently went up into Canada and talked to Menashe and got this story and then printed it on his website. In fact, I interviewed Robert Perry not too long after that.
Robert Perry is a spook. He's an intelligence officer. He, like Brian Hutchinson, supplied the background thing for Ari Benbenashe or many of the other spooks when they require a background thing or an actual movement. One of the tricks they do is if an intelligence officer moves into a new area, they put him up in the newspapers saying something completely different, giving a completely different background check so everybody knows who he is and what he is, supposedly. And once you start looking at this, you then start to realize, just exactly what's going on. And you talk about Robert Perry with Global Research. In the London bombing in 2005. There's on the 23rd of July, there's the Brazilian electrician, Jean Charles de Menezes, was executed in a most horrific way on one of the subways or trains in London.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that was July 7th, 2005, that these three bombs went off in three separate trains.
Four bombs. Don't forget the bus.
Okay. Okay, right. The bus and then the three separate trains.
There's three separate trains and then an hour later the bus.
Okay.
And the bus was right outside Tavistock Place. Now, Tavistock was the, who was it? General John Rawling Rees took over that in 1926 and started doing his own little operation group. Really psychological warfare.
Right.
Low intensity operations. Of two of the names, have a guess what the third name for their little operations were.
What?
Terrorism.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, goodness. Now, you said that Robert Perry was a spook back in 1990, and thus he must still be a spook today.
Yes. Now, I'll go back to Jean-Charles or de Menezes when he was executed. Professor, was it Michael Chudnovsky, also of Global Research, put out an article within 2 days saying the British police trained in Israel. Now, the British Metropolitan Police, would never, ever train in Israel. The British Metropolitan Police consider themselves superior. They've been fighting the IRA since 1915. They know all about the terror tactics. They went right through it in the 1970s. I was over there in 75. And we did the, I was doing piping at Earl's Court and then Colchester and then Edinburgh Tattoo. Met a few of the policemen. The Metropolitan Police consider themselves to be the superior police force of Great Britain. And if they would never go around to be taught, they would always do the teaching. They were superior. They never did that. But again, when you have a look at the in the manner of which De Menes was executed, that somebody put him in a rugby tackle, pinning his arms down, while the second person went up to him and fired 7 or 8 shots into his head. One missed, a couple of, went through the missed the body completely. Another two hit the body, not the head. This is an out and out execution, but it's definitely not the way you execute a person wearing a suicide bomb. If you get that close to him, all you need is one thing to go wrong, and you suddenly lose a whole police squad of the three men. So you have a look at that style of execution. You put it down to, it also describes in the manner of which Thomas Hamilton was executed. And the question you'd have to ask from Dr. Carver is, was Adam Lanza, did he commit suicide standing up or lying down?
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest way to hold a person still is when he's lying down. The only part of the body that could possibly move would be his head.
And Lieutenant Paul Vance stated that he shot himself with a Glock handgun. And of course, we don't even know whether they tested him for gunpowder residue or any of that kind of thing. We don't have any of the science, and they're certainly not going to release anything.
No, they really don't want to. And I'd be very surprised if there is a coronial inquiry for what happened at Sandy Hook. I'd say you're going to get something like the Lord Cullen inquiry, which happened at Dunblane, sort of thing, where it will be a totally government controlled exercise, and none of the witnesses who aren't on board will not be admitted. With the Cullen inquiry, was Constable Craig McCutcheon, the first police who attended the scene. He was not invited to give evidence, and once Sandra Utley discovered that, and it took her a big battle to get hold of his police statement. She got hold of that, and it just blew the Cullen inquiry out of the water.
Right.
So. You know, it's amazing what people can do, you know, just by getting in and getting hold of the documents and reading the documents. The witness statements can tell you a lot. That witness statements can vary a little bit. They might get a few little minor facts wrong. You know, a bloke might have been wearing jeans, or they might be blue jeans, black jeans, or whatever, and you might be different type of shoes. But they'll have a general description of the person, of what they remember, and once you read them all, put them all together, you'll get a general idea of what's happened. And you know, it doesn't matter what crime, whether it's a massacre of 20 children or whether it's a motor car accident.
Right.
The witnesses will give you a reasonable idea of what's happened. And please remember, as the police aren't there at the time, the only evidence they have to go on are the witness statements.
Right.
So mm-hmm. You know, when a witness will tell you, you know, this has happened and that's happened, and you say, well, how do you know? He says, I've got the witness statements. And I think it was Dan Oates of Colorado. He says, we've got over 200 witness statements. Well, he's got the gentleman sort of thing, who saw the person open the door inside the theatre and hold it open. The person who was answered his mobile phone, then moved to the fire escape door and held that open.
Oh, right. Who was that? Yeah.
Corbin something or other.
Yeah.
And then I watched it beauty. I saw another one. It was Christopher Ramos or something or other got up and made a statement to Kinnaid Corbyn's statement, and it was an actual ripper. And once you had a look, once you listened to him and studied his methodology, you realised that he was a professional witness. Because this Chris Ramos got it, he was being interviewed. He totally ignored the interviewer's questions until they suited him. And he just went on and on non-stop. And where we take a pause or use the words to allow us to stop and to catch our thinking up to our mouth or whatever, this bloke used other keywords to replace us. So he continually kept on talking and didn't allow the interviewer time to interrupt him. Professional witness.
Right.
And, you know, it's...
And of course, I think a lot of the... Well, this Sandy Hook, I think there were a lot of actors, because if you look at some of the video, you see people just kind of walking around in a circle as if there was a lot of activity when actually it was the same people just repeating, you know, just walking around.
Yes. The governments have... Look, at the Port Arthur massacre, things again went wrong. The government lost seven operatives that were killed. There was three killed in the Broad Arrow Cafe, and there was four killed from the BMW at the toll booth. But once you go through and you start looking at the witness statements, there was about at least another about 25, 30 there. There was four CIA, or I call them CIA, there's four American intelligence there. And that's not including the two anti-gunners, Mary and Dennis Olson, from Vancouver in Washington, who was supposedly there on their honeymoon.
Right. And they thought they were safe and ended up getting shot.
Well, the thing with the Port Arthur massacre was the original target was two, we call them busloads, big coachloads of American tourists who suddenly arrived there at 12:30. And if they had been shot on the ferry as everything had been prepared for, then Bill Clinton sort of thing would have immediately forced the Australian government to bring in gun control by the State Department and with treaties. And again, those things would then bounce back on the American, and Bill Clinton in 96 would have brought in gun control in America.
Right.
I understand in 94 he did bring in some, but after the Port Arthur massacre, if the American tourists had gone down there, he would have got a full firearm ban, you know, against in regard to the Second Amendment. So, and people, you say this to them, and they say, "Oh no, that couldn't happen." Well, you're now finding out that you know, what happened 17 years ago in Australia is happening today in America.
Right.
And it's all a political agenda. It's all emanating from the United Nations and from the Democrat Party that supports and follows the United Nations. So, you know, we have the same problem in Australia with the Labor Party, you know, that they follow a United Nations or the internationalist agenda.
Well, I think it's orchestrated opposition. You have the Republicans saying, "Oh no, we can't have gun control." Then you have the Democrats. I mean, it's just orchestrated opposition, and they both work for the same body, and they pretend that they're opposing each other, but they're all in this together.
Yes, they all collect their superannuation at the end of the day.
Sure.
And they're all controlled by the same people. And it becomes quite obvious. One of the loveliest things you have a look at is Benjamin Netanyahu goes out for 9/11 and he says, "This is good for Israel." And then you go to the London bombing on 7/7 and he's out there and he says, you know, "I was warned, you know, just before." You say, "Well, who warned you? Which Arab warned you?" No, I was warned by Scotland Yard. No, you weren't. Scotland Yard. So I was then warned by the security at the Israeli embassy when about 5 minutes before the first bomb went off. No. The first bombs that went off were not described as bombs. They were described as electrical discharges. There was only when the bus blew up, sort of thing, the people said bombs. So no matter which way Netanyahu moves, he was, the lies came out, but Netanyahu never lied.
No, he seems to have an insider track on all this stuff.
Well, he's ex-Mossad, isn't he?
Yes.
Right. And you then go and have a look at the Israeli politics when, at the time, London bombing, Benjamin Netanyahu was the finance minister. He goes back to Israel, and Ariel Sharon is not at all pleased with him.
Oh, right. And then Ariel Sharon has a health issue.
No. First of all, Netanyahu is sacked as the finance minister, or he resigns as the finance minister. He then moves into the party to try to to replace Ariel Sharon. That doesn't work, and Ariel Sharon is not too happy with him. And blow me down if not later Ariel Sharon suffers a stroke and is put into hospital. He's getting over that one, and he meets with one of the members, and he then has another major stroke, and he's in he's still in a coma today, I believe.
Right.
They haven't let him die. And Barry Chambers, a very good Zionist journalist. I don't follow all his views, but he's a truthful man. Has written some excellent articles on the Ariel Sharon assassination. And definitely Benjamin Netanyahu is up there, because once Ariel Sharon was removed, Benjamin Netanyahu filled his position quite well, thank you.
Yes. How handy, how convenient. There's so many conveniences in politics, isn't there?
Yep.
So many coincidences and...
All right. Well, let's get back to Joe Viles ran the Port Arthur massacre.
Okay, that's interesting.
Joe Viles was videoed on the balcony or the front, at the front door of the Broad Arrow Cafe 15, 20 minutes after the actual shooting took place. He's there with Hans Overbeek, the father of the gunman, Benjamin Overbeek, and Constable Justin Noble of the... He was a member of the New South Wales Police Force. He was attached to the BCI, which is the Bureau of Criminal Intelligence, which is a federal Attorney General's Department body, and it's one of the most corrupt police forces in Australia. In fact, it was noted of the 39 Victoria Police members who had been forwarded to the BCI, 13 of them were known to be corrupt. Of the other 26, there's no such allegations, but the actual fact that there was never a report in regard to the corruption of these members means that the whole body was corrupt. They
sure,
covered up.
They cover each other. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So... They were the three people outside. Joe Viles ran the Port Arthur massacre, and once that was made public knowledge, Joe Viles suddenly died, and then reversed back to being Ari Benbenashi. And if you read the article I sent you properly, you'll see where they switched sides, and you can see the proof that the lies and the pitfalls in the stories have been put out.
Right. Yes, I did read that, and I thought, "Whoa, this is very unusual." Given that I talked to Robert Perry, and you also mentioned that Joe Viles was the guy that wrote about the Iran-Contra affair in the late 1980s. He wrote a book called "Prophets of War," and he is the same person that that uses the name Ari Benmenashe,
The book "Prophets of War" was written by Ari Benbenashe, but Ari Benbenashe is Joe Viles.
Right.
Now, Joe Viles has written He's had articles printed in the Nexus magazine in Australia. One of them was called The Terrorist Factory, and where he states quite emphatically that he was the gunman that shot the policewoman Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy in London in 1984. And then when you check Fintan Dunn's site, Fintan Dunn will tell you that Peter Power, the person who was running the operation for the London bombing, he was the police officer in charge of the police forward command post outside the Libyan embassy when this murder took place.
Well, you've certainly pieced all these things together. It's an international affair. It isn't just a local thing that went down in Sandy Hook, at Sandy Hook. Yes.
The other thing I found extremely interesting were the couple of the media reports on the school massacres or general massacres all over the world, and not one of them mentioned the massacres that took place in Australia or New Zealand.
Right.
And I thought that was extremely interesting. Why would they exclude Australia? Philip Alpers, who was supposedly to advise Joe Biden, is it the vice president?
Uh-huh, Joe Biden.
Was to advise him how the National Coalition for Gun Control in Australia was so successful. So, again, all the connections are fitting up together, and it's becomes quite obvious that the Sandy Hook is part of a political agenda, to attack the Second Amendment.
Right.
So, and I certainly do hope that it fails. Either countries, both Australia or America, can do about corrupt government. But governments have been corrupt for a long, long time. But I don't know how we can get rid of some of these horrible people that are in our government bureaucracies. But you definitely, the Second Amendment is there, for the protection of the people against tyrannical governments, and I wish Australia had something similar.
Right. I think they used to.
Australia has always been a penal colony. Australia was settled as a penal colony.
Okay.
Its first bureaucracies were set up as a penal colony, and they have never changed.
Hmm.
That's why Australia always seems to be clinging onto the skirts of another government. Be it Great Britain or be it America. Our bureaucracies and government have never had the capacity or the ability, to stand alone, most unfortunate for us.
It is, and Australia has some very difficult laws. I have friends down there who have been accused of hate crimes and have been economically destroyed because they criticize certain people. And they've been labeled as anti-Semitic, and it's really terrible. And we're getting to that right here in this country, very quickly.
There's similar laws in Great Britain and in Canada. I'll point out to you, the two main countries that are pushing gun control for America and the removal of the Second Amendment will be Australia and Canada. Most probably Great Britain will be in there as well, but it will be more hidden than what Australians are the most vocal. As I said, Melbourne has is the low nut gun massacre capital of the world. And so it just goes to show you that the internationalist power in Melbourne is extremely strong.
Hmm, okay.
Which is a shame. Who was it? What's the Irving doc? What's his name? Is it David Irving?
Yes, David Irving. Mm-hmm.
David Irving was once asked, what happened to the Jews, that didn't go to Israel as refugees after the Second World War. He said, "Well, most of them moved to Melbourne in Australia."
Ah, Or they came to New York, or they went all over the place. I mean, a lot of them, they moved into Russia before anything ever happened. A lot of people don't realize that, but Walter Sanning wrote a book about that and how they moved all these people around. I mean, it's just a matter of relocating people, and then you can claim later that, oh, these people were all murdered.
Well, Heinz Kissinger and his family emigrated from Austria in 1938. Perhaps they knew what was going to come.
Undoubtedly.
But I had a friend, George Bruce, who was in the Victoria Police Force. He had served in the British Army as a conscript. He'd served in Palestine. And he made the comment that you can meet a lot of very nice young Jewish girls over there, and all they wanted to do was to marry a British soldier, sort of thing, so they could escape from Israel. It was, these people weren't Zionists; they were just Jews who had been forced to migrate to Israel to set up the new colony there.
Sure, they were poor, and they. The rich ones all left and went elsewhere, and so the poor Jews were still left in Europe. So they sent them down to Palestine to do all that work, you know, all the heavy labor.
Yes, and naturally enough, you listen to the propaganda, and after a while, sort of thing, you believe it.
Sure.
So it's very difficult. Anti-Semites. That's only when you go against the.
The Palestinians.
The hierarchy of the little Jewish thing.
Yeah, I mean, the Palestinians are really the only Semites in Palestine right now in the Israeli state. I mean, the rest of them are...
Well, Professor Stan states that quite emphatically.
Right.
And somebody else who wrote a book called The 13th Tribe would also adhere to that view. So.
Yes, there are several books. Well, it's been very interesting chatting with you.
Well, I hope I've passed on sufficient information. What's happened at Sandy Hook is virtually the same that happened at Dunblane in Scotland in March 1996, and what's happened in Australia at Port Arthur in April of 1996. And that was a game when President Clinton was trying to bring in gun laws. He'd already brought in the... things on firearms and that in 1994, I believe. So you ask why he had the, why were these massacres required? And it's going simply to remove the Second Amendment, to stop all or any Americans from owning firearms, sort of thing that, like the AR-15 that could be used for other than sporting purposes.
Right. And, of course, you have a Clinton in both situations with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Yeah. They're certainly globalists, for sure.
Yes. I was always of the belief that Hillary was going to become the first female president of America. But she didn't quite measure up to Obama. So you've got your first black president. I doubt if you'll have another one for 100 years after what he's done to your country.
I hope not. Well, he's definitely his mother was Jewish and his father was a communist, and it certainly wasn't Barack Obama Senior. So he was certainly shoved onto the American people.
Yes, unfortunately.
Yes.
I just wish that Ross Perot had got in.
Oh, yes. I campaigned for him, and I worked at the campaign office. And as I say, I still have my campaign button.
Good.
But I think that probably was, he made a lot of his money from government contracts. So he probably was just asked to step in. Just to divide the ticket so that you could get Clinton in. So, you know, all this stuff is all orchestrated so that they get in who they want at an appropriate time to pass whatever legislation that they're working on.
You know, I think It was Roosevelt FDR status, something like that. If it happens, it was orchestrated politically. Sure. Wise. Yep.
Sure.
All right, then. I think I've annoyed you for enough. I hope there's sufficient relevance of what we've talked about today. I hope the message gets through. But Sandy Hook definitely had to go down as a massacre. Very much the same as the Oklahoma bombing, you know, to demonize the militia.
Sure.
And as soon as it was Mike Harris who put out the thing about Mossad did it, as soon as that came out, as soon as you get the thing that Mossad did it, you know it's a government-run operation, and it's gone, it's really gone, it's been stuffed up terribly.
Right.
I don't know who the missing gunman was, but definitely Joe Viles, Ari Benvenashi would have been involved in the planning of it. Definitely.
Well, that is very interesting. Very interesting. Well, thank you so much, Andrew, for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Dina.
All righty.
I hope to speak to you again sometime. Take care.
All righty. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.